Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakravarti.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And here's a fact. Greater Boston is experiencing an urban renaissance.
Also fact, Greater Boston is experiencing an escalating housing crisis.
Just how long can the two realities coexist before something has to give? Before the significant advances the region has made begin to slip away simply because it's too expensive to live here?
That's the urgent question or questions lurking behind the Boston Foundation's 12th housing report card released today. Barry Bluestone is the lead author of the report. He's professor of public policy and urban affairs at Northeastern University and director of the Dukakis Center. And he joins us now in the studio to help us tackle some of these questions. Welcome back to the show, Barry.
Good to be here.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't mean to sound alarmist in that introduction to talking about housing, but I kind of heard alarm bells ringing in this latest housing report card. Because, for example, right here in the executive summary, I see written that despite Greater Boston's economic recovery, we're doing better on things like wage increases and unemployment than the rest of the country, the area's high cost of living has steadily eroded the real standard of living for nearly all but the affluent. So is it right to feel more than a little alarmed?
Well, we've been looking at this for more than a decade. And the latest numbers, just to give you an idea of how shocking this was to us, is that if you look at renters in Boston, more than half of them, of all the renters in Greater Boston, are spending more than 30% of their income on housing, leaving less for everything else. Even worse, more than a quarter of all renters, 26.4%, are spending more than half of their gross income, half of their annual gross income, just to pay rent.
Okay, so let's stop there because I want to just repeat this fact. 25% of renters in Greater Boston are spending more than half of what they earn just on rent alone.
And what has happened, particularly for renters, is their incomes have been pretty flat over the last decade, but rents keep going up year after year, whether we have a booming economy or even went up during the Great Recession. And a lot of that has to do with pressures that have been building and building and building in Greater Boston now, at least since 2005.
Mm. We're going to talk about what those pressures are specifically and what we can do about it. But I also want to just get a quick snapshot on what the state is for homeowners. I mean, renters are a group who maybe have, you know, the idea of owning a home is not necessarily a reality for them right now, and they're suffering. But those people who are able to maybe get into homeownership, it is really tough for them as well.
Absolutely. If we go back and we look at the year 2000, we had about 27%, less than 27%, were paying more than 30% of their income to cover their mortgages and taxes. Today, that's 38% are paying more than that. So that's a huge increase in the number of families who have homes but are paying a disproportionate amount of their income to support those homes.
Yeah,
those homes.
In the report, you call them cost-burdened homeowners or cost-burdened renters.
Exactly.
What is the impact on this region that we live in and love when such a huge proportion of people are cost-burdened for renting or ownership?
Well, what happens in Boston, if you took just the city of Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, is you're seeing that we now increasingly have two kinds of people living here. The real affluent who can afford, you know, $4,000 a month in a condo fee, in a condo or rent, and those people who are so poor that they actually qualify for subsidized rent or live in public housing. We've been losing everybody in between who have to move further and further out to find housing they can afford. The result is we're getting a society here in Greater Boston of rich and poor, of the haves and have-nots. It's almost like a third world country that we're becoming if this continues into the future.
Okay. Well, on that note, listeners, we want to hear from you. How much of your income are you spending on housing or on rent? Do you feel like it's sustainable? Or are you feeling, as Barry Bluestone just said, pushed out? What can we do about it? This new Boston Foundation report, the 12th annual housing report card it's put out, says, quote, correcting our overpriced, mismatched housing stock will require a whole new level of political will and economic imagination. Do you think that will, that vision is there? What are your ideas to fix this housing crisis that we all, almost all of us, seem to be enduring? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston, and do send us a tweet. In a moment, we'll hear from Boston's chief of housing, Sheila Dillon, as well. But before we do that, Barry, one of the new things, other than just the, I'm going to say it, shocking numbers regarding how the burdens of the cost of living here, is that you and your co-authors sort of outline the demographic trends in a new way that are really driving this and making the problem even more acute. And it's this sort of battle between millennials and baby boomers.
Well, it's not so much the battle between millennials, let's say 20 to 34-year-olds, many of whom have not yet paired off and gone off and had families, and baby boomers. It's that the baby boomers, like myself, are now looking, many of us are looking to downsize. Mm. Not all of us, but many of us would like to stay in the communities where we grew up. Maybe it's Newton or Watertown or wherever, but we're finding there's very little housing that's appropriate for us. And so we're stuck either in our big home or we have to leave the community where we have friends in our church or synagogue. For millennials, there is some good news here. And the good news was that a decade ago, millennials were just leaving. They come to Northeastern, where I teach, and as soon as they got out, they'd go somewhere else. And that was true of a lot of our graduates. Now they're staying. That's good news. But they're doubling up, tripling up, quadrupling up with roommates, and they're renting the old triple-deckers that were built between 1870 and 1920 for working families. And so what they're doing is it making it more and more difficult for the working families to stay here. And they're dealing with the cost burden by four of them sharing exorbitant rent, and so they can afford it. We need to find a way to build housing for them and also to change our zoning laws so we can have the appropriate housing for those baby boomers. And if we do that, we could serve the millennials, we could serve the working families with the older stock, and we could rehab that to make that really nice housing for them and then produce the kind of housing that I need. And as I love to say, at my age, approaching 71 years old, I need very few amenities, but one of them is an elevator.
Those elevator buildings come at a premium, that's yes, for sure. You know, it's interesting because you call this Boston's third demographic revolution, right, essentially. But in previous demographic revolutions, you know, the early 20th century wave of immigrants, and then the post-war baby boom and the return of soldiers and suburbanization, it seemed as if the market responded, though. I mean, housing was built, those triple-deckers in the early 20th century. So the suburbs grew wildly in the 50s and 60s. The market is not responding in the same way this time around.
Exactly. I mean, we had Boston. This is amazing. Between 1870 and 1920, the city of Boston's population triples from 250,000 to 750,000, much of that driven by immigrants. We built triple-deckers and small apartment buildings for them. We housed all of them. All of them. And then after the World War II, we, of course, saw a decrease in the population in the central cities like Boston and Chelsea and Somerville. But we saw this massive growth in the suburbs. And again, we built housing for all of them. This time, we have a third demographic revolution of the millennials and the aging baby boomers. And zoning rules and regulations in the suburbs keep developers from developing the kind of housing that we need. And in the city, it's hard to find the ability to produce housing at a cost that young people can afford. So for the first time, we have a demographic revolution, and the market is stuck.
Okay.
It can't respond.
It can't respond for a lot of, or can't slash won't respond for a lot of different reasons. I mean, there was one fact that jumped out of many in the report that you write, that many communities ban multi-unit apartment buildings. For many years, there have been zero permits for multifamily housing in the vast majority of Boston's communities.
Exactly. And what's happened is that the people who live in those communities, most of our suburbs, have banned multifamily housing or use zoning to restrict it because they want to keep the community just like what it was 10 or 20 years ago. And I keep saying to these communities, because I'm one of them, saying, look, we're changing. We're getting older. We need a different kind of housing for ourselves. So if you want to keep us in town, you don't want us to leave. you have to find housing for us. It's not so much about your fear that those other people are going to move into your community. You're not producing housing for the people who've lived there for 40 years and have paid taxes for 40 years. That's what's wrong in the suburbs.
Barry Bluestone is professor of public policy and urban affairs at Northeastern University and director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. He's the lead author on the Boston Foundation's latest report on housing in Greater Boston. Barry, stand by for just a second, because this seems to be a perfect moment to bring in Sheila Dillon. She's Boston's chief of housing and director of Boston's Department of Neighborhood Development. Today, she happens to be on the far left coast in Seattle, Washington. But Sheila, it's great to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. So, good to be here.
So let's pick up right where Barry left off with this idea that, one of the big fixes, which we've talked about before, a lot on this show, is permitting and just changing housing policy so that we can just open the floodgates and get more units built. Is that possible? Do you see movement for that in Boston itself? Hi, Sheila, are you with us? Looks like we lost Sheila. We'll try to get her right back, but we've got a lot of callers who want to join us instead. So let's go to them. Ivan is calling from Bedford. You're on the air, Ivan.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this great topic that is the main issue in this community besides MBTA. Anyways, I think the city has failed, the state has failed, and we as a society have failed in creating housing, using public resources the way we used to, where we used to be able to, we should be able to float bonds and be able to use those bonds to create public housing that perhaps that can stay in the community, where you can put a clause where if you get into a house, a preferential pricing, a preferential market rate, you can only increase a certain percentage per year. And when you sell, you have to follow the covenant that does not prevent you from selling the house at the full market price, because the reality is that we need poor people, middle-class people in the city of Boston. Mm. And as a teacher, I tell you that I've seen how two families live with what is designed for a one family, and that is not conducive to good learning.
Ivan, thank you so much for your call. Barry, your response to that?
Yeah, I think what we have to do is figure out whole new ways of creating coalitions that will work on this housing issue. So one of the things we're talking about, just one segment of it, is what I call, and we've talked about this before, millennial villages for our 20 to 34-year-olds, in order to give them housing so they can move out of the triple-deckers, which are more appropriate for working families. To do that, we need some zoning changes about size of unit, about parking. We need some state bonding authority to bring the finances. We could use some state, local, and MBTA-owned surplus land, particularly if we could put this near T-stops. And we need to find a way of also developing, working with great architects, great designers, new forms of housing. Some of it could be manufactured housing that would be exciting and more cost-effective. So this is the time, particularly given the extraordinary numbers we've talked about, for the mayor of Boston, the mayor of Somerville, the mayor of Cambridge, the new governor to get together, bring people together. I'd love to see them bring architects, designers, construction workers, construction firms, and say, how can we make this happen? Then bring in universities and teaching hospitals where many of these young people are either working or going to school. How could you help us develop this housing? So we need a new paradigm to solve this problem.
Because it's a big problem. And so a paradigm shift does seem to be priority number one here. It looks like we have Sheila Dillon, Boston's chief of housing, back on the line with us. Sheila, sorry about that. Technical difficulties. But let's pick up where Barry left off. Is there room for a paradigm shift or a movement in a paradigm shift in terms of, freeing up the financial, the intellectual, the bureaucratic resources to really tackle the housing problem? Oh, looks like we lost her again. Today is not a good day to be connected to Seattle, where Sheila Dillon is. Okay, so Barry, let's step back here for a second, because you've got a lot of very eye-opening numbers. I mean, we've been talking about millennials, but you note that, for example, for housing for baby boomers or seniors, 65 plus, who are feeling the increased burden of the taxes, for example, and the cost of upkeep of their homes and would like
shoveling
to downsize.
The snow.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We would need 22,000 plus units for just this group alone. So this is really a problem that that touches all everyone but the most affluent. But I noticed a tone in the report here that I don't think I've necessarily heard as clearly in previous ones, and that is one of lack of optimism.
No, I wouldn't put it that way. And the reason is that I think Mayor Walsh is really concerned about this. Sheila is working on this, so we hope we get her back on the line. I just had a wonderful meeting with Jay Ash, the Secretary of Housing and Economic Development. This morning when we released this report at the Boston Foundation, we had the head of DHCD, Department of Housing and Community Development. And I think they're recognizing from this report and from other information they have that this is something you really need to tackle. It's interesting, just make a parallel. Last week, I happened to be in Israel before the election. And, of course, in the end, the election turned out to be more on security in Palestine. But all the talk in Israel was about housing prices and young people unable to stay in Israel and emigrating away from their homes because home prices have gone through the roof. So we're seeing that housing prices and housing is such a critical issue that political leaders in Israel, the ones who lost, unfortunately, and here are starting to realize this is as important for economic development, this is important for our constituencies as any other issue. So I'm actually somewhat optimistic that the numbers are now so stark, the demographics are so powerful, that we are going to have our political leaders and our business leaders finally getting together to do something really serious about it.
I've got a tweet from Leah Strauss who writes, "I am one of those people who pays more than half of my income on rent in Cambridge. It is real." Let's turn to another listener, Steve, who's calling from Winthrop. You're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Magna. Hi, Barry. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your thought?
I heard Mayor Walsh talk a little while ago, a few months ago, about how the city of Boston doesn't have any problem with building high-end housing that's very profitable on a private development. You know, if you turn a profit, there's no problem with it. But if you go into, like, the places... If you work in downtown Boston and you want to have an easy commute to your work, then, you know, there's not a whole lot of space. You look at, like, Millennium Place and things like that that are going up. Those places are $1 million plus.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, where is it going to be built? It seems like it would need to battle against market forces.
Right.
Because if the high-end housing is the stuff that's really profitable, then how do we get it to happen in a way that ensures that, like has been happening in Somerville, foreign investors don't just snatch up every single property once it's built and then sell it at a markup?
Steve, great question. It's one that I've been wondering too, because the market as it stands seems to be heavily skewed towards, if anything does get built, it's a lot of upper income / luxury housing.
Well, developers do that because partly this is where the money is, and partly because zoning makes it more difficult to build housing that's affordable, and partly because of the high costs. That we got to solve all of those. There is land available. Think of it this way. Boston now has about 635,000 people in it. In 1950, it had 801,000 people in it. The city has not expanded or contracted by one inch. So we know we can house 800,000 people. We don't have to do that. What we have to do is see what land is available. There's a lot of land, for example, that the Olympics Committee is talking about around the Bayside Mall. The same kind of housing we're talking for millennials could be used for building the Olympic Village using some of the same techniques. There is land around some of the T-stops, Forest Hills, for example, where we could build housing. We have to be less worried about going higher, 12, 14
right.
stories.
The future
this doesn't
up.
Bother me.
Exactly.
We've just rezoned Kendall Square so that we're getting more housing there, and MIT is building graduate student housing as part of that. So I think this argument, there's no land, really doesn't hold water. There is land. It may not be zoned appropriately. There may be land that we have to figure out how we can appropriate for this kind of housing.
Yeah. Barry, in the last minute that we have left, I want to circle back to the big question that we started this conversation with, and that is, you know, we have seen this glorious urban renaissance in the greater Boston area. This is a fabulous place to live if you can afford it now. I mean, how long is that renaissance truly sustainable if the people who are creating it, you know, the small business owners, the young people, the teachers who teach in the schools, the 99% of us can't afford to live where we work.
Well, you know, as Paul Grogan said this morning in his introduction to this report at the Boston Foundation, this is actually a kind of problem you would like to have relative to some of the other problems. It is great that we have young people wanting to live in Boston again and not going to Brooklyn and not going to God knows where. It is great that we have older citizens who want to stay in Massachusetts and not go to Florida. But it is a challenge because in order to keep the region vibrant, in order to be able to replace those baby boomers who will be retiring with young workers to take their place, we need to solve this housing problem, and we need to do it in a way that we don't end up with a city of rich and poor and then further and further out in the suburbs where the working families can live. Paris is a great example. Hmm. Paris has moved all of its poor people outside the city. When the riots occur, they don't occur downtown. They occurred further and further out because there was no affordable housing inside Paris for working families.
Yeah.
We don't want that to happen in Boston.
Don't want that to happen. Don't want to be rendered to developing country status. I'm hearing all the right words from Barry Bluestone. And listeners, we've got a link to Barry's latest report at our website, radioboston.org. There are specific policy prescriptions there, which I definitely encourage you to read. Again, radioboston.org. Barry Bluestone, director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy, thank you as always.
Glad to be here.
Listeners, there's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.